Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good morning and welcome to QTalks. This is Shweta Mishra, your host, and today we are talking to Dr. William Matsui, the Deputy Director of the Livestrong Cancer Institute, about multiple myeloma stem cells and their role in drug resistance in myeloma management. Dr. Matsui specializes in caring for patients with cancers that involve the blood and bone marrow, as well as bone marrow transplantation. Welcome to the QTalks, Dr. Matsui.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Pleasure is all our, Dr. Matsui. On the patient panel, we have Gary Peterson, Jack Aiello, and Cynthia Schmielewski. Gary, Jack, and Cindy, welcome to the show. We will be discussing questions sent in via email at the last few minutes of the show. You can email your questions to shweta@trialx.com or post them on the page where you're listening the show right now. You can also dial in the live show using 718-664-6574 and ask your questions. Without further delay, I will now hand it over to our co-host, Gary Peterson, to lead the panel today with Dr. Matsui. Gary, over to you now.
Well, thank you. This is kind of a replay, but not really. What happened was we've had a number of people who were so thrilled with your prior presentation here on Cure Talk and had requested an update from you on what's going on now. But before I do that, Dr. Matsui is the Deputy Director of the Livestrong Cancer Institute at Dell Medical School. He specializes caring for patients with cancers that involve blood and bone marrow, as well as bone marrow transplantation. Dr. Matsui came to Austin from Johns Hopkins, so I'm going to drop a few names. That's a big one. Where he was a professor of oncology and served as the director of the multiple myeloma program and co-director of the division of hematology or hematologic malignancies. Dr. Matsui received his undergraduate degree from a little school near Boston called Harvard and his medical degree from the University of California at San Francisco. He completed his residency at University of Washington in Seattle and then his clinical training at Johns Hopkins. His laboratory first identified cancer stem cells and plasma cell malignancies in 2003 and subsequently other cancers, including lymphomas, leukemias, and pancreatic cancer. Dr. Matsui's laboratory has also demonstrated that several pathways regulate normal stem cells, including those involved in embryonic development or abnormally activated in cancer stem cells. So welcome, Dr. Matsui, for your encore performance.
Thank you.
And congratulations on your new assignment.
Great, thanks. Yes, I've been here for about a year now, and things are going well.
Well, that's fantastic.
And we're just getting stuff started. Yep, go ahead.
Okay. Now, your prior presentation on myeloma stem cells was, like I said, very, very well received. And as a result, people would like to know what kind of new insights you may have. But before I would do that, could you please provide a refresher for any of the people listening, who didn't listen to the last one or, just for our own benefit?
Sure.
What are myeloma stem cells and why are they important for the treatment of myeloma and
sure.
Perhaps even a cure?
So basically, the idea of stem cells in cancer is really based in this idea that even if you have, a bunch of different cancer cells within an individual patient or an individual tumor, that they are actually different from one another. And so they may look different, and so that happens quite a bit, where you can have tumors where the cells look, tumor cells look one way and then they look a different way, but they're all still related. They're all cancerous. And besides looking differently, they can function differently. So some of them are more apt to grow and produce more tumor cells than others. So the idea behind the originally behind cancer stem cells was that we know that from a bunch of different lines of data that the ability to grow new tumors, like not every cell has that. And there are only, typically it's a minority of cells in a tumor that can do that. And one analogy that's easy to sort of, I think about is that if we think about our blood and how our blood development occurs, it's from hematopoietic stem cells that live in the bone marrow. So there are very few of those things. In a person, there are probably about 100,000 true hematopoietic stem cells, but they are responsible for producing about 90 billion blood cells every day for your entire life, right? So there are very few cells that produce a lot of other cells, and so cancers may be similar in that way, where there are very few cells in a tumor, but they are responsible for generating all the other tumor cells. So with cancer stem cells, and this is an idea that's been around for quite some time, really the first evidence of this was in leukemia, where you had leukemia cells that looked more like, they were more immature and they looked more like hematopoietic stem cells, and those were cells that were found to be able to transfer cancers from like an animal to an animal or from a human into an animal. And it was really those cells that now matured, and then they gave rise to the actual cancer. So what we did was we tried to study that phenomenon in myeloma, and we did this a number of years ago. And if you think about myeloma, it comes from, it's a disease of the immune system. And in the immune system, you have a bunch of different cell types, but one of them are B cells. One of the types are B cells. And those cells, really the job of those cells are to form, you know, at some point mature, become plasma cells, and the plasma cells secrete antibodies. And so just like in the normal system, in myeloma, what you have is you have myeloma plasma cells, they secrete a protein, and that's the M spike or your involved light chains. And the question's always been, well, where do those cells come from, right? Do they recapitulate the normal system where they come from B cells, or are they by themselves able to generate more cancer cells? So in the normal system, it's thought that plasma cells don't make more of themselves. Like they have a job. Their job is to make antibodies and secrete those antibodies to provide immunity, but their job is not to make more of themselves. That's the job of B cells. So B cells are less mature and they become plasma cells. So back in the day, about way before I started studying this, people had demonstrated that in myeloma patients, besides having plasma cells, you could always find B cells that were related to the plasma cells, but the B cells were quite rare. And nobody really knew what to make of these things and how they were involved in the disease. And so back around 2001, 2002, so many years ago, what we decided to do was to try to see what the function of B cells versus myeloma plasma cells were. And the function that we looked at was the ability to grow. So in the patients we studied, we were able to find that plasma cells, even though they're abundant, they're what causes all the health problems for patients, are not able to really grow very well, whereas the B cells were able to grow in mice that had no immune system and sort of reform the myeloma. So that is sort of was the start of everything. And that idea of having a specialized compartment by which all of the cancer cells arise, like I said, is an idea that exists in just about every tumor. Whether or not that idea is really what happens in people is something that we're trying to all figure out. but that's sort of the basis for where we started and where we got the idea. So about the time that we started studying this, there were there'd already been data in studies in acute leukemia, and at the same time that we were studying myeloma, there were two other diseases. One was brain tumors, and then the other was breast cancer. And so these three diseases, all about the same time, reported that you could find specialized populations of cells that had this particular property. So that's kind of where the field started, and it's just like every field, you know, in medicine and in scientific history has had its ups and downs over time. But that's really the sort of the scientific basis of how we think the disease is organized.
Okay, so why is it important for a future treatment and perhaps cure?
So I think you know, one is that, you know, if we think about myeloma these days, especially newly diagnosed patients with myeloma, we're pretty successful with the medicines we have of making individuals go into, you know, have a response or go into remission, right? So you can make the burden of tumor cells go down. And what we're measuring there are we're measuring the plasma cells, right? So we're measuring either the M protein that the plasma cells are making, or measuring, we do a bone marrow and we look at, you know, how many plasma cells are left, right? So we're looking at that compartment. The issue is that if we think about sort of what happens to patients, most patients, unfortunately, with myeloma are going to end up relapsing. So what that tells us is one particular thing, which is, you know, the treatments that we're using, right, where we make, you know, we can have people go into complete remissions. We can have them even become, you know, a term that people have been throwing around is to have minimal, you know, not have minimal residual disease or be MRD negative. And even with that, most patients are going to relapse. Just about all patients are going to relapse. So what that tells us is that the medicines we're using are not able to eradicate some part of the tumor, right? We're getting rid of almost all of it. There's some part that is left behind that is causing people to relapse. So it's really difficult to cure someone, right, if they keep relapsing, right? Basically, if you cure someone, it goes away and it doesn't come back. So I think that, you know, in this very simple way, you know, for me, it's sort of like, well, if I can somehow control cells coming, you know, that are responsible for the disease growing back, then maybe that will maintain remissions. And if people never relapse, then I would say, you know, perhaps they're cured. So
okay.
I think that those, looking at those, you know, the specialized function of those cells, they have to do two things. One is they have to be resistant to the drugs we're giving people, and then the other is that they have to have this ability to grow back at some point. And those are two properties we think that myeloma stem cells have.
All right. Well, one thing, as I recall last time we had discussed this, you said that, you know, I think myeloma doesn't express CD19, but the B cells do. And there's been a few trials now utilizing, you know, like BCMA and CD19 and you know, some others. I know there was one with Dr. June at UPenn. And I was wondering, given you know, that there was, if you used CD19 as a target, that it eradicated or actually provided a response, and seeing as how it's not on plasma cells, you know, that your thoughts were that perhaps, you know, they are on B cells, and maybe that confirms what you've been talking about for years now. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think that trial is like, you know, it was a, you know, for me personally, I think it was a very, you know, it was a great opportunity sort of test what we had thought about and studied in the lab and actual people. So we had done some earlier trials where we used an antibody against B cells called rituximab and didn't really see much of a result. And I think that, like, CD19 being on these cells, you know, you really want something potent that can get rid of those cells, and CAR T cells were the thing that Dr. June's group, in particular a young investigator there named Alfred Garfall, ran that trial, and they used CD19 CAR T cells as a way of trying to get rid of myeloma stem cells. And really, I think that, you know, part of the, you know, the question is, well, why did they do this? I think, you know, part of it was, you know, an interest in the science of, or sort of the biology of myeloma. But the other was, is that, you know, they had worked very hard and had developed CAR T cells against CD19 for many years. And they were successful at using these in B cell leukemias and in B cell lymphomas. And so they ultimately got approved in those diseases. But, you know, here was an opportunity to try them in a different disease. And so myeloma was one of the diseases that they tried. And so in this study, you know, the study was done in a very particular way. So they took patients who had had an autologous stem cell transplant, and then they took patients who had relapsed actually quite quickly after the first transplant, so within a year. And typically, you know, there's controversies about what to do with these patients. Some people say, well, you should retransplant them. Other people say you should, you know, move on from transplantation. But so they took patients who had relapsed within a year, and then they did a second transplant. But typically when you do a second transplant, you give a lower dose of melphalan than you do the first time around. So it was with a lower dose of melphalan. And then right before they did the transplant, they harvested T cells or immune cells from the patient, and this is done by the same thing, same pheresis that you would do for stem cell collection, and they engineered those cells to be anti-CD19 CAR T cells, so they were going to target CD19. So the patients got a lower dose of melphalan, they got a stem cell graft back, and then after that they got their CAR T cells back. And really the measurement there was to try to figure out, well, how long did the patients go before they might relapse again? And so there were about 10 or 11 patients on this trial. And in a handful of them, like three or four, there were patients who had a longer amount of time before they relapsed from the second transplant than from the first. Then if you think about it, you know, you're using a lower dose of melphalan and you've already gone through one transplant and it hasn't given you a long remission. So typically those, in most cases, and they looked at this in their own experience at the University of Pennsylvania, the patients who had a second transplant almost, you know, would never ever be in remission longer than the first transplant they had. Which made sense, mm-hmm. right? So in this study, when they got CD19 CAR T cells back, patients actually had some of the patients had longer remissions. And if you look at those, you know, particular patients, there's a couple of pretty interesting patterns. But really, this idea that the patients were going longer before they relapsed, and there's still, I think, some patients who are pretty stable. That was sort of a clue that maybe CD19 was a viable target in myeloma. And, you know, they had the plasma cells from the patients. They showed that the plasma cells did not express CD19 and in any of the patients, which, you know, is pretty normal. And so they couldn't attribute what they saw to just the CAR T cells attacking the plasma cells. They had to be attacking something else. So that was really, you know, a great trial for us because it provided some evidence that this idea we were talking about was true. And, you know, there was some subsequent studies that were done in the lab, and we participated in some of those with the Pennsylvania group to try to figure out what was going on. So one of the things we did was we compared B BCMA targeted CAR T cells and CD19 targeted CAR T cells and their ability to, you know, prevent the growth in the lab of myeloma samples from patients. And, you know, one of the thoughts about, well, you know, they had tested CD19. The other, you know, if you have heard anything about CAR T cells and myeloma, just about, you know, all of the studies have been using not CD19, but this other target called BCMA. So, you know, one of the issues is BCMA targeting, you know, the cancer stem cells, because if that's the case, then you should not get anybody relapsing. And but in studies that have been ongoing, I think in most studies, most patients have ended up relapsing. So that suggests that BCMA is not, you know, an important antigen to try to prevent relapse. And so when we did this comparative study in the lab, we found that in some patients, if you kill CD19 positive cells, then the tumors would not grow. In some patients, if you killed the BCMA positive cells, the tumors would not grow. And if you killed both the BCMA and the CD19 positive cells, that actually, you know, prevented tumor growth in just about all the patients. And so, the one thing, you know, when people ask, well, why do, you know, more people not believe this, right? Which is a totally fair thing to ask, because it's not something that people talk about a lot. So one of the issues, and it's an issue just not in myeloma, it's an issue in the entire field of cancer stem cells, is this idea that you have a cell, it can do something, but it has to look a certain way, right? So what you're doing is you're marrying, like, the phenotype, what's called the phenotype, to its function. So one way to think about that would be something like, okay, if you have someone and they're wearing a uniform that looks like a police officer, you automatically assume that person is a police officer, right? So the question is that, does that relationship hold? Does every policeman always wear a police uniform? Or is it that they can wear something else? Or is that everybody who's wearing a police uniform, is that person automatically now a police officer, right? So the answer to both of those things is, of course not, right? Because you have people, like, on Halloween, maybe some people are dressed up as police officers, and they are not obviously police officers. So I think that the rest of the world, I think, got fixated on this idea that the cells that are causing relapse have to look the same in every single patient. And we had identified that. We thought that way in the beginning, right, where CD19 and B cells were the cells that were causing these things. But if we look at the data that we generated with the UPenn group, it ended up being that in some patients, BCMA was important to try to prevent relapse, and in some patients, CD19 was important to prevent relapse, right? So one way to interpret this is that in patients, right, so if you take a bunch of different myeloma patients, the cell that is the stem cell, right, like nobody is going to deny that there's some cell that's causing people to relapse, right? What the argument is that, what does that cell look like, right? And what I think is that cell may look different in different people, and it might look different if you are newly diagnosed versus if you've relapsed a number of times. It may be different if you have disease in the bone marrow, or if you have what's called extramedullary disease, where you have disease in other places. And so one of the things that was notable about the Penn trial is they had a single patient who had extramedullary disease. So they had plasmacytomas in other places of their body, and they had myeloma in the bone marrow. And when they got the CD19 positive cells after their transplant, it ended up being that all of the bone marrow disease went away, but their plasmacytomas did not go away, right? So it may be that the stem cell in the bone marrow is different than the stem cell in the plasmacytoma. So it could be that if you think about, well, what are the factors that could determine what the cell looks like? Well, like I said, it could be that, you know, if you have MGUS or smoldering myeloma or newly diagnosed myeloma, that may be different than having, you know, active myeloma or relapse myeloma, the cells might look different. If you have different genetic abnormalities, so some people will have like a 414 translocation, some people will have amplification of chromosome 1Q, some people will have a 17P deletion. So maybe the cells are different based upon the genetic abnormalities, right?
Well, so, that makes it far more complex, doesn't it?
Right. And so I think that, you know, when people say, well, what was the issue with your idea? The issue with the idea is, as we said, we thought B cells are important. And now what I think is that B cells are important in some patients, but may not be important in all patients. And so, you know, it is much, much more complex. And I think that the same thing has been identified in leukemia. There's some, you know, thoughts about maybe the same thing holds in another disease that we study in the lab, pancreatic cancer. And so we just don't know in an individual patient what the right thing might be. And, you know, to sort of one way to combat that is to sort of say, well, if targeting both BCMA and CD19 with CAR T cells seems to work in the lab, then what about doing that in patients? And there was recently a paper from a group in China where they did that. They used BCMA CAR T cells and CD19 CAR T cells in the same person, you know, in the same individuals, and they saw some interesting results as far as like generating remissions, although the follow-up time was short, and so you can't really tell if someone's going to not relapse if you don't follow them for quite some time. And then the other is that there are similar studies that are being initiated at Penn, where the original study that was done. So it is a complex thing, and it's one of those things where, like, you know, I am been, you know, I've had a lab for almost 20 years now, and I think that, you know, the biggest lesson there is that, you know, you can think, you can find something, you can interpret that a certain way, you can think that that is the way the world works, but, you know, in something like humans and in diseases like cancer, that is almost, there are many, many variants of what you might see. So
okay.
I think that part of it is important to remember.
Okay, we're running a little long, so I was wondering if we might not go to some of the questions from the
sure.
other people. Jack, you online?
I am online, Dr. Matsui. It's always nice talking with you. Thank you for being available for this.
Sure.
I'm still trying to get clarification on this whole issue, so. We're always told that myeloma is a very heterogeneous disease. Even within the same patient, myeloma cells, plasma cells, don't always look the same as one another. So when you talk about relapse, why isn't it some of those different plasma cells that are causing or leading to the relapse as opposed to a myeloma stem cell?
So I think that there's this issue, right? So the issue is that do you call a cell by what it – do you name it by what it does or do you name it by what it looks like, right? So I think that the right thing to do is to name it by what it does, right? So if it's a cell that's responsible for relapse, then that's the cell. And I think that what we've learned is that you can't say that it is – one particular appearance that leads to that phenomenon, that what a cell looks like and what it does is not necessarily true in every single patient or every single case. But I think that you don't – so there's something that causes relapse, right? Because just about all patients relapse.
Correct.
What that cell looks like, right, I think is totally up for debate. Right, and I am not a person that says, well, I'm 100% right, and it's got to be B cells. Like, I'm never going to say that. In some patients, I think it is plasma cells. There's things that kind of look like plasma cells, but I don't know in which patients that's the case, and in which patients I think B cells are more important. And we're trying to figure out ways of determining that in the lab. And I think it's important because if you're going to use a CAR T cell that targets a specific thing, then you want it to target the thing that's going to prevent you from relapsing, right? And that's the issue, right? So how do we get about doing that? That is like the $100 million question at this point in time. But there is heterogeneity, and I'm not saying that there's one thing in particular. It may be different from person to person.
So why doesn't myeloma treatment, or maybe it does, also affect the myeloma stem cells?
So I think it's because of the way we develop drugs. So if you think about it, we have a new drug, right? We found that drug helps, you know, mice with myeloma in the lab. So now we want to go and try it in people. And let's say it's an entirely new drug. So the first trial we're going to do is really a safety trial. So we're going to give it to people and make sure they don't get sick. And if it goes beyond that, the next trial is to give it to, let's say, myeloma patients and to see if it, quote unquote, works, right? So what is the test that we use to see if it works? Well, we give it to the patient, and then we want to see their M protein go down, or we want to see their plasma cells and their bone marrow go down, right? So if we are focused our drugs on that, then and we're attacking those specific cells, and those cells are not the cells that are necessarily responsible for relapse, then we're not going to ever, you know, generate. Not, you know, prevent relapse. And so if you think about it, those the steps that a drug needs to go through is to first be a good plasma cell killer. And, you know, the first clinical trial we do after safety is not, does this drug cure people, right? That is not the first study. So the first study is always like, let's see if it can get rid of some of the cancer. And then if it does, then we'll test it and we'll see if people have, you know, longer remission times, et cetera, et cetera. So the way that we do drug development completely favors attacking the most prominent cell that's there. And if that cell is not the cell that causes relapse, then you're going to totally miss the boat.
So are you able to isolate myeloma stem cells in the lab?
We can enrich for them, meaning that if you have, let's say we take the bone marrow and we think that it's 1 in 5 million cells, we can do things to get it down to 1 in maybe 1,000 cells. But if you said, look, I want a test tube full of just myeloma stem cells, like the only way we can figure that out is by putting them somewhere and seeing if they grow. And we are not able to just isolate a single cell and say, well, this is the stem cell. It's always like a population, and it's always still a minority of the cells in that population, but we whittle it down from 1 in a million down to like 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 100, something like that.
So when you talked about in the lab comparing CAR T CD19 versus BCMA in the lab study, you're still testing against the myeloma plasma cells versus the myeloma stem cells.
Right. So in those studies, what we do is we just take whole bone marrow from the patient, right? And so I don't care what the thing looks like. I'm going to be able to tell what it looks like by using my CAR T cells as a way of killing whatever is there with that marker. And if I add the T cells to the marrow and then I try to get the marrow to grow and the myeloma doesn't grow, then I would say, look, that's because we killed the thing that was being targeted by our CAR T cells. And so that is sort of by inference what we think that the stem cell looks like.
Well, I want to ask one more question, but I guess I'll save it to the end, and that is, where are you going from here? I mean, how do we get rid of these myeloma?
Well, if you can figure it out, then that would be great. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to figure out there's a specific – so in cancer biology, when people have studied cancer, they've been interested in very specific functional properties. So one is how do the cells grow? Like how do you go from one cell to two cells to four cells, right? And then the other is how do you kill the cell? Like what allows it to survive chemo or whatever? So it's really like cell survival and cell growth have been two of the major properties that people have studied. So the one property that they have not studied is a property called self-renewal. And what that means is that you can produce more cells, but you can do this over a very long period of time, right? So it's cell growth over a very long period of time. And if you think about it, if you think about that analogy about normal blood production, your hematopoietic stem cells have to be able to produce blood for the entire time that you're alive, or else you'll run out of blood and you won't make it. So that ability to keep growing and growing and growing and growing and growing and growing over time, right, that is a different property than just growing. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to figure out what are the pathways that affect this property called self-renewal, or like the ability to maintain that growth potential over time. And so that's one way that we've been trying to attack it. Like, we're just saying, look, we don't really care what the cells look like. We just think that they have this property and that this pathway or this factor controls that property. So let's just attack that and see if we can, you know, prevent the cells from growing back.
Well, thank you. I'll sure. Pretty intriguing. I'll turn it over to Cindy.
Hi, Dr. Matsui. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Okay. Well, when I first started learning about this topic, it was very confusing. You're making it a little less confusing for me, but I guess I was asleep in my biology class, so I'm not quite sure what all these things mean. So can we just go back and have like a little basic biology lesson? Like, mm-hmm. We're born with a set number of stem cells. Is that correct or no?
We are. So one good example is women and their ovaries. So okay. You make all of the eggs you're going to make when you're a fetus.
Okay.
And then when you become an adult, you start using those eggs and you take them one by one, and then you're not making any more of those. So that's where you're pulling from a pool of cells. In the brain and in the skin and in the gut and in the bone marrow, you need to have stem cells that are producing all of the cells that you need to sustain that organ. So you need to have skin cells all the time. You need to have neurons all the time. You need to have blood all the time. So the stem cells are the things that give rise to those. And whether or not you have a fixed number of them or you can make more of them is a hotly debated thing, and it probably depends on what organ of the body you're talking about.
Okay. So now these stem cells, do they know from the beginning what they're going to become, or does something in the body act upon them and tell them to differentiate into a certain thing? Or don't we
so
know?
There is some, it's both. So if you're a bone marrow stem cell, you're going to bank blood and that's it, right? But you might say, look, if I have an infection, then maybe the bone marrow cells are going to make more neutrophils because neutrophils are there to fight infection rather than making like T cells or B cells or whatever. So there is some, so a cell is restricted in sort of what kind of organ it can be involved in. So like a stem cell in your skin is only going to make skin, right? It's not going to make kidney. And, but if there are multiple cell types in that organ, for sure, stem cells, if you think about it, need to listen to their environment in a very, very specific way. So if we're making 90 billion blood cells a day, right, if we make a little bit less, then we're anemic and neutropenic and don't have enough platelets. If we make just a little bit more, then we have leukemia, right? So it's got to be really, really, really precisely, incredibly precisely regulated. And we don't know how it's regulated. Like in myeloma, there's regulation because for most patients who develop an M spike, right, their other immunoglobulins go down. So there's some suppression of the normal plasma cells by the myeloma plasma cells, right? So there is some feedback going on, and there's arguments in the field about whether stem cells, all cancers come from stem cells, and it's really just whether or not they're good at listening to the cues in their environment, whether to grow or not grow, that causes cancer. So that's one of the theories about cancer.
Okay. Makes sense. Now, when I was trying to prepare for this talk, because it was really confusing to me, I Googled hematopoietic, or however you say it, stem cells, and I see that those stem cells that are found in your bone marrow, there was this big like hierarchy. Some become myeloid progenitor cells, some become lymphoid, and the lymphoid cells become lymphocytes, then B lymphocytes, then plasma cells. So the plasma cells all the way down the chain. So when we're talking about a myeloma stem cell, are we talking about the plasma cell, or are we talking about the stem cell that's like the B lymphocyte or the lymphoid progenitor? What is that myeloma stem cell?
So I think that, you know, as I was saying earlier, I think it can be anywhere from B cells to plasma cells. And that may depend on, like, the patient and the genetic abnormalities and where they are in their treatment, et cetera, et cetera. So they are, for sure, they're not at the level of, like, a true hematopoietic stem cell. Right?
Okay.
That makes myeloid cells and all those other things. Because you can tell that it has to come from something where the antibody genes have been changed, and so that only happens in B cells. So it's somewhere in B cell development they come from. And but, you know, the one thing about B cells and T cells, that part of your immune system, like, there, you know, we get immunized as a kid, right, against polio. And what we presume is that we're going to carry that immunity for the rest of our lives, even though we're not going to ever run into polio. So it ends up being that B cells and T cells, part of the immune system, they have some capacity, even though they're not going to make a bunch of different things. They're only going to make other T cells or other B cells or plasma cells. They have an ability to hang around forever. Right? And we know that because you have immunity forever. And so what are the things that regulate those cells that may be the same or different than other, you know, neural stem cells or hematopoietic stem cells or gut stem cells or whatever? We don't really know. We don't really understand that so well. But for sure, like, if you think about it, B cells hang around forever because they're there to protect you against certain pathogens forever. And so it makes sense that if you have a cancer that comes from those cells are going to last forever because that's what they already normally do, right? They're not altering any of that just by becoming cancer. So that's sort of what we're fighting against. We're fighting against, like, normal biology here because the cells want to hang around. So how do we get them to stop doing that? Well, there are a lot of, well, I wouldn't say there's a lot of theories. There's some theories about how to do that. But we just don't know.
Okay. So so what we're hypothesizing is that myeloma may be growing or relapsing in more than one way. That one way it may be that the malignant plasma cells are dividing, but that might be unlikely because regular plasma cells don't have the ability to divide. And a second way they may be, myeloma may be relapsing or growing is because something happened to one of its stem cells that became mutated, and this mutated stem cell is now becoming a malignant plasma cell. Or did I get this all wrong?
So I think that it could be either of those cases. Like, we don't have any evidence that it's one version of that or another, right? And so I think that either of those is a possibility, right? And I think that it may be that both of those scenarios happen in the same exact person. So let's say in the beginning, maybe it is a normal B cell that gives rise to plasma cells, and let's say that gives you MGUS, right? And the plasma cells are not dividing. As you go on through your therapy, and it becomes myeloma, and then you go undergo treatment, and then it relapses and stuff like that, diseases tend to get more aggressive, and so maybe there's a new stem cell, right? And maybe that cell is more like a plasma cell than it is a B cell. Like, that's the way I kind of think about it now. But if you say, well, what is the proof that that's the case? I'll say, well, I have a little itty bitty tiny bit of proof, but I'm not necessarily, you know, I wouldn't say that that's definitive. And so, like, I think that, you know, for me, a lot of it is, well, you definitely have something that comes back.
Okay.
So let's deal with that. And what it looks like, I think it, to me at this point in time, it doesn't matter as much. Like, but I think that people in the field, in myeloma, this is what they get fixated on. It's like, well, what does a stem cell look like? Because you're saying that it looks like B cells, and I'm saying, look, I don't think that it is B cells in every person. I think it might be other things, might be plasma cells. And, you know, I think getting fixated on answering this question of what does it look like is not going to get us anywhere to some extent. Like, we don't care what things look like. We care what they do. And that is like, so we're trying to figure out, well, what are the functional properties of these cells and how do we deal with that? Whether they look like, you know, anything, I could care less as long as what I'm trying to do is to prevent them from doing what they're supposed to do, which is regrow the tumor. So that I think is a little bit of the way I approach it. Because people say, come up to me and say, well, you know, are you still studying B cells? And I'm like, yeah, we're studying B cells, but, you know, I'm not sure whether or not that's the right answer for every single patient with myeloma. And I don't know in which patients that might be the right answer for, but I think that in some patients it's important, and maybe, you know, patients have five different kinds of stem cells in them, and, you know, are we going to have to attack all five, right? Probably that's the case. And so I think it is much, much more complex than I ever thought it was going to be when I started our initial studies.
Yeah, it seems very complex to me. But from what the fifth grade teacher is thinking is that there's just not one way to target the myeloma. We need to target and kill the myeloma cells that are already there, but we also might need to find what those cells that are making the myeloma grow or divide also, because usually plasma cells aren't the ones that do the growing. Is that correct?
That is 100%. You nailed it. That's 100% right. Like, I think that we got to get rid of the plasma cells in patients when they're diagnosed, because that's what's making them sick. And we can't have sick people, right? We're doctors. We want to take care of those people. On the other hand, at the same time, we want to try to prevent the disease from coming back. And that's the way we can cure them. And so what are thoughts about how to do that? Well, it may not be using the same exact drugs that we use to get rid of the plasma cells. So that's really the point is there a way, is there some alternative strategy that we have to combine with just getting rid of the plasma cells to really try to prevent people from, you know, relapsing after they've achieved a remission? And that, to me, is the question that I hope I can answer with whatever time I have left here. But that's, you know, I think we can kill plasma cells, myeloma plasma cells pretty well. We have a bunch of different drugs or new drugs approved, but keeping them away, keeping them from coming back, that I think is the challenge, right? And I don't think that just hammering away, giving more plasma cell directed drugs may necessarily do the trick, because everything we do, they tend to come back. So we should think about doing something maybe a little bit different.
Well, I'm glad that you're looking at a different way of doing this too. Now, the other thing I want to know is that people now hearing when I attend these conferences, the tumor microenvironment. So where does the tumor microenvironment fit into this whole scenario?
So I tend to think about the tumor microenvironment in a different way. So the way that people think about it in myeloma is that it is supporting the plasma cells. And the way I think about it is the way that, you know, as we, you know, for anyone who studies stem cells, like stem cells, as I was saying earlier, have to listen to the environment, right? They have to know when to grow, know what to become, right? And the only way they can figure that out is by clues around them. So that is the microenvironment for stem cells. And normally in stem cell vernacular, they're called niches. So they're stem cell niches. So they're these special places where stem cells live in the body, and those niches protect the stem cells from, you know, different insults, et cetera. And what we've been trying to find is are things in the environment that form these niches, and that is not easy to do. But I think that the environment that most people study is like, well, how does that affect plasma cells? And I, like I said, it's not that I don't care about that, but I'm more interested in trying to figure out things that are affecting long-term growth of cells, of tumor cells. And those are probably different than the things that, you know, prevent plasma cells from getting killed with Velcade. So it's just a different way of looking at it. But I think it's important. But it's important in sort of a different fashion.
Yeah, I think it's important, too. It's always good to attack things in multiple ways, and that's what I think you're trying to do, is finding a different way of making the myeloma go away as just opposed to killing the myeloma cell, trying to do something else. So thank you so
right.
much.
Sure.
Thank you, Cindy. Well, right now I'd like to go and have Shveta
yes.
go to the callers online.
Thank you, Gary.
I know we
yep.
have one. We have one. I think Dana Holmes was the one who was very excited about this presentation and wanted to ask some questions. And she also was one who had requested that the Dr. Matsui
yes.
would come back. So would you go forward with that?
Yes. Dana is online.
Yes.
Yeah, Dana, please ask your questions.
Oh, yes. Hi. I'm online. Dr. Matsui, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to do this. It really, truly is a gift to the myeloma patient community. Appreciate
Thanks.
It so much. Yeah. A fellow patient who's also a scientist attended a recent seminar by Dr. Carl June, mm-hmm. and she asked him about myeloma relapse. And he mentioned that there was really no good animal model for myeloma for testing theories due to the nature of the disease complexity, and that it was so important to learn from clinical trial non-responders to understand why. And, you know, as I'm listening to your... I'm realizing that there could be no truer statement, because you're really learning as you're going along with these trials and asking additional questions. Even though you might be answering some, you're asking additional ones. It's just so complex. I mean, there's hope behind this, but there's also a little dismay listening to how complex this is and that the relapse factor is real for every patient. So my question is, since high-dose melphalan does not kill off these elusive dormant myeloma stem cells, which may be responsible for relapse, isn't this drug just making these cells which are left behind more aggressive and leading to more mutated cells?
So I think that is a super fascinating question, and I don't know the answer to that. There are certainly, when people have tracked different, you know, patients over time, what you can see is that the myeloma, the specific, like, genetically marked myeloma at the end, right, that is
uh-huh.
really drug resistant, doesn't do anything, that is actually present. You can find evidence of that way at the beginning when the patient was diagnosed, right? So that was a study that was done at the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale. And so the question is like, you know, the fascinating question there is like, if this thing was so nasty and aggressive at the end, then why was it not like the thing that appeared in the beginning, right?
Oh.
And so
uh-huh.
the way I interpret that is that, well, maybe the myeloma that is not so aggressive is somehow interacting with the really aggressive myeloma and completely suppressing it, right? So there's competition
uh-huh.
or there's interaction between those. And so if you get rid of all of, like, this slow-growing myeloma, then all of a sudden there's nothing left but this really nasty thing that comes out. So
mm-hmm.
that's one way that I tend to think about it. But for sure, like you know, the patients that I that I've had do sort of the best over the longest period of time are there two groups. One are patients who get allogeneic transplants who are pretty much, I think, cured, right? And then the others are patients who will relapse, but they relapse with such sort of non-aggressive disease. It's almost like they have MGUS again. And so those patients, like, you may not even treat. You may not put them on maintenance. You may not treat. They have a little spike. It's always there. It goes up every once in a while, and then it goes back down. And people are just stable with that for years. And so the patients that I have, I've had a number of patients with that sort of pattern where, you know, they do great. It's not like their myeloma is gone, but it is so sort of dormant that it's not bothering them. And that is, like, mm-hmm. as good as a cure, in my opinion. So yeah. Whether or not, like, these aggressive things come about because we're treating people more and more and more and more, or is it because there's a sort of a – and you're getting mutations, or is it because you're sort of disrupting this interaction between different, like, aggressive myelomas and non-aggressive forms of the myeloma in the same patient? I don't know. But, like I said, I think that if you can have MGUS, if you can, like – give someone MGUS who has myeloma, my guess is that their myeloma is going to be stable. But that's just mm-hmm. like a thought that I have. And so,
yeah, that's interesting. Is there a way to identify the MGUS phenotype? Is there a way to test those cells or those residual cells and say this is an MGUS-like type of disease that will kind of stay and just hang out without doing damage for the next 10 years or so?
You know, we don't. Like, for me, most of those patients, like, will have, you know, pretty gradual relapses, and then they'll kind of be relapsing, and then they sort of plateau off where it doesn't look like their spikes are going up, you know, up anymore, and then they kind of just hang out there. And like I said, you know, I've had patients like that. I've had them on maintenance for a long time, and then at some mm-hmm. point I say, look, I don't know what the maintenance is doing because it's not making your stuff go away, so, you know, if you have side effects or whatever, let's stop your maintenance, see what happens. And I've taken a lot of people off maintenance and they completely remain stable, right? They didn't
wow.
need the maintenance. And so I think
yeah.
if we could figure that out, right? Like, I don't know the myeloma patient who would rather have MGUS than myeloma, right? And if we could figure that out, that would be great. But I think
yeah.
identifying those patients up front is really, really hard.
Mm. Well, while we wait for this complex puzzle to be unraveled, obviously you mentioned allo transplants, but that's not the standard of care for myeloma patients. Auto transplants are.
Right.
Would a certain subgroup of patients be able to forego a stem cell transplant and see a reasonably equivalent overall survival? And if yes, what type of patient, and are you able to identify them as they're newly diagnosed?
So I am a person who is not necessarily, I don't think that every single patient needs to have an autologous stem cell transplant. Like, if we look at the data, it's hard to know whether or not an autologous stem cell transplant is going to prolong overall survival, right? We know it prolongs the time to relapse, but
right.
we don't know whether or not it makes people live longer overall. That is totally debatable. And so
mm-hmm.
without that evidence, I think that, you know, since it's the standard of care, you need to talk to every patient, newly diagnosed patient, about that. But I'm not necessarily someone who pushes everyone to do it, right? And I think
mm-hmm.
I'm different from my colleagues in that way. But, you know, you can do it, but my guess is you're probably going to relapse from it, right?
Yeah,
and,
yeah. So yeah, absolutely. And that's
right.
always my sticking point, you know,
right.
to move forward with a high dose of melphalan, which potentially could have short and long-term effects on even the immune system and that microenvironment.
Right.
It's really a big, big, big decision to make.
So I'm, like I said, I think that people should hear about it. They should understand
mm-hmm.
what it might provide. But I don't say to people, look, you have to have this. I think that that's the wrong thing to do.
Well, great. Well, Dr. Matsui, again, thank you for your time.
Sure.
And all of the wonderful things that you're doing, and fingers crossed that you'll be able to move all of this incredible research forward.
Great. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You, Dana.
Thank you, Dana. Thank you, Dr. Matsui. I think it's time we wrap up this talk now. Although the exact nature and biological properties of multiple myeloma stem cells remain elusive, what we know about them is that they have pronounced drug resistance and are believed to be the root cause of failure of many myeloma management therapies. We heard Dr. William Matsui of Livestrong Cancer Institute share the latest research on multiple myeloma stem cells and how they are helping scientists carve new paths in novel drug development to treat multiple myeloma. Dr. Matsui, thank you very much for your time and all the information you shared.
Thank you, Gary.
Jack, and Cindy, and the audience, thanks for your insightful and informed questions that brought out a very informative discussion. The talk will be available on curetalks.com. Please visit our website for details on our upcoming talks. So until the next time, thank you, everyone, and have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Matsui.